This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. It's been a slow period for many actors because of the pandemic, but not for my guest Oscar Isaac. He stars in the Paul Schrader film The Card Counter, which is now available to rent on Amazon and other streaming platforms. Isaac starred with Jessica Chastain in the HBO limited series Scenes from a Marriage, which concluded earlier this month. And he's one of the stars of the new film Dune, adapted from the Frank Herbert science fiction novel. Isaac has managed to have a successful career in independent films, including his breakthrough role in the Coen Brothers movie Inside Llewyn Davis, while also being in blockbusters like the Star Wars sequel trilogy and X-Men Apocalypse. We'll start with a scene from The Card Counter, because I love this film. It was written and directed by Paul Schrader and has many echoes of Taxi Driver, which Schrader also wrote. Oscar Isaac's character, who goes by the name William Tell, is a man who holds everything inside, but some kind of explosion seems inevitable. He's a card counter who goes from casino to casino, almost always winning, but keeping his bets modest so he can remain unnoticed. Let's start with the opening voiceover as he's writing in his journal from prison. We don't yet know where this fits in the chronology of the film or why he's in prison. He says that as a young man, he was terrified of confined spaces and just wanted to drive and drive and drive. So when he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, he was surprised to find he adjusted quite well. He goes on to explain.
I like the routine. I like the regimen. Same activities, same time, every day. The same toothbrush, the same clothes, same toilet, same stale sweat. Stale smoke, stale bodies, stale cooking, stale farts. Same conversations. The faces change, but not much. No choice. I found that I liked reading books. I'd never read a book before. Not all the way through. I found a life for myself that had been beyond my imagination. It was in prison I learned to count cards.
That's Oscar Isaac reading from the character's journal in The Card Counter. Oscar Isaac, welcome to Fresh Air. Such a pleasure to have you on our show.
So happy to be here with you.
I love this movie so much, and it's part of director and screenwriter Paul Schrader's series of movies about a man alone in his room, or God's Lonely Man, which is a line from Taxi Driver from his journal. And you know, Paul Schrader has described these films, which include Taxi Driver, Light Sleeper, First Reformed, as a man alone in a room wearing a mask, and the mask is his occupation. I also think of these characters as being dead inside, like something they've experienced has caused them to basically be, you know, yeah, to be dead inside. And typically they find something that's on the verge of bringing them closer to being alive again, but that thing doesn't last long.
Well, it was interesting because I wouldn't think of him as dead inside. I would think that the mask is kind of a deadening, you know, the card counting mask, this kind of self-imposed purgatory that he's put himself in, where he just basically is running out the clock on his existence, playing low stakes, blackjack and poker, just enough to get by. And that kind of is the wall that he's built around himself. But inside, what was important for me was to feel like there's this furnace that's brewing, this kind of volcanic thing that's in there that he's desperately trying to keep down, that is a bunch of rage and self-hatred and rage at the people that have put him there.
Guilt.
Guilt. And really, the biggest thing is trauma. And that's one of the first books that Paul sent over to me, which is The Body Keeps the Score, the great book on trauma, incredible book. And he's got all this trauma that's stored in there. Shockingly enough, trauma that, you know, often we think of trauma as there was a, you know, you're the victim of somebody perpetrating some abuse on you, but he's been traumatized by the abuse that he was told to perpetrate on others. And so that's part of this massive burden that he holds, where even after spending, you know, 8 to 10 years at Leavenworth, he gets out and feels that that wasn't enough.
Wasn't enough punishment?
No.
And can we say that the trauma is as a result of having served in the Iraq War and things he had to do or was told to do during that war?
Yes, he was asked to do very horrible things, to torture people. And he did it because he thought it was the right thing to do. And I think the biggest trauma of all is that he was good at it and he had it in him.
You know, you mentioned purgatory, that this character is living in a purgatory. Paul Schrader, who wrote and directed the film, was brought up in a very strict Calvinist family where, I mean, there was no dancing, no singing, no movies allowed. You grew up in an evangelical family. And I'm wondering if the idea of hell and the devil and eternal suffering was very real to you when you were growing up.
What we grew up with, and it was funny because I was just talking the other day with my sister about this, is we grew up with a very, very real sense of the impending doom of the apocalypse. We had pictures, paintings. Often my father would be preparing for it, you know, by storing up supplies. It's funny because she's a scientist. She's a climate scientist. And so it's funny that her profession ends up being about the end of the world in some ways. But we grew up with that sense that it was around the corner at any moment. And will you be left behind?
Oh, so it was the left behind thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to be left behind in the years of tribulation with the mark of the beast and
the plagues.
All the plagues that are coming and all that. No, yeah, that was a real sense. It was less about if you've done right or wrong. It's like, how much do you really believe in Jesus? You know, do you really believe? Are you just saying that you do? So it's that kind of thing. Was definitely in there. And with that feeling, that anxiety that, do I believe? Do I believe enough? Maybe I'm lying to myself. Maybe I am going to be left behind. Is it coming? What's it going to be like when we hear the trumpets, you know, and the sky breaks open?
Wow, that's a lot to deal with as a child. So I want to get back to the card counter. You have voiceovers of the journal that you're keeping. And it's, of course, obviously very very much an echo of Taxi Driver, where Travis Bickle has his diary that he reads from or that he narrates through voiceovers in the film. I think you said that Taxi Driver was basically in your DNA. What was the impact of that film on you? When did you first see it, and what does it mean to you? And maybe how has the meaning changed over the years?
Right, yeah. I saw it, I think I must have been 16 years old. That was one of the ones that actually made me want to make movies. And I remember me and my friend started making lots of movies, kind of emulating Taxi Driver and driving around in his car and his little Honda in Florida and making these short films. It was magic to me. And seeing the arc of this character go through all these different phases and the energy of that thing and the kind of subversive punk rock nature of it as well, so much so that by the end he has a mohawk, and I was in a punk band in high school, and it just spoke to me on so many levels, feeling like an outsider, feeling a lot of rage, I think, against my upbringing and the dissolution of my family. And, you know, it just connected with that existential despair, and then the idea of doing something about it, and then just like the fantastic nature of those violent scenes when he finally comes in and takes out all the bad guys. You know, there was just it was like a punk rock opera.
And has the meaning of it changed to you over the years?
Yeah, it's sadder now.
Mm-hmm.
I see it now, and it's, I didn't really get the trauma of it before. Now, seeing somebody so horribly wounded, that scene with Peter Boyle outside of the cafe, you know, and he's saying, it was such a beautiful example of lack of clarity, you know. It's like everything is just an aborted sentence all the words that he's saying, and then Peter Boyle has like the most inane response, and there's just something about that I found so beautiful, the inarticulateness of it all.
So in Scenes from a Marriage, your wife is played by Jessica Chastain. It's about a dissolving marriage and the after effects of the dissolution. I want to play a clip from Scenes from a Marriage, and this is from the third episode. And so it's been a year since you and your wife have separated. She left you for another man. And since she left, you and your young daughter, Ava, have stopped using the upstairs rooms of the house. And your downstairs office is now a bedroom for you and your daughter, Ava, with a partition dividing their bed spaces. And in this scene, Mira's come over to the house, and she still has feelings for you. And while you've moved on with someone else, you're still in a very vulnerable place. So you both start kissing, and then you stop her, and you say this.
I don't think you actually really understand what it was like for me here a year ago. That first moment, I was just on autopilot. I woke Ava up, I got her dressed, I dropped her off at preschool, and I canceled all my classes, and then I came back home. And I thought I was literally losing my mind. And there was a moment where I thought that I didn't even want to stay alive. And there was lots of moments where I was sure I didn't want you to stay alive. Like I really wanted you to die. And then there was a moment when I wanted Ava to die. For that to be my revenge. And then that night she started coughing like crazy. And at one point she threw up from coughing so much, and she spiked a fever of 104, and I wasn't sure if I should take it to the emergency room. And so I ended up putting her in a bathtub. And that lasted all night. And I was scared to death. I thought I'd killed her.
That's my guest, Oscar Isaac, in a scene from Scenes from a Marriage. You were a father by the time you shot that scene.
Yeah, father too.
Yeah. So do you think there was like an emotional depth you were able to bring to it? Because I think all parents worry about something happening to their child and carry around a certain amount of guilt for something that they did do or should have done or wish they'd done. Or
yeah, of course. We didn't have to reach so far. You know, I'm not an ex-torturer living a life in a casino. I'm not a space king. You know, this was sometimes, at the end of the day, I'm filming a scene in this little wooden bed with a five-year-old playing my daughter, reading her a book with this little bunny lamp on. And then I'd get in the car, come home just in time to lay down in a little wooden bed with a book with the same exact bunny lamp reading to my four-year-old, So, yeah, I think those things, I didn't need to reach very far to feel emotionally connected to them.
There's been so much social media in terms of Scenes from a Marriage about your looks, about, you being sexy, about your body, because there's a very brief, full frontal shot. What's your reaction to that? I know you're not that big on social media, but how do you feel about people commenting on your body and in a very positive way?
I was surprised that a guy left that in there because it gives it away that I'm not, that I wasn't raised modern Orthodox.
it's maybe too brief to really notice.
I hope so, but some people clearly caught on.
That's so really funny. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I was like, I don't know. I wouldn't have done that, but all right.
maybe that was a behind more, shot would have been better.
A little more fourth wall breaking, I guess, is going on there. I don't know, I think it's just part of the thing now, you've got so much, many more voices that are able to kind of talk and be heard, and it's, I wasn't bothered by it.
So 2017 was a really life-changing year for you. Your mother died in February. You got married in March. Your first child was born in April. During that period, you also played Hamlet. The impact of having death and new life so close together must have been, well, I don't know, maybe you can say a little bit about what it was like. I've seen that happen so often where somebody, where an older member of the family dies and then a new baby is born. You know, talking about impermanence, what was it like for you to have, you know, death and new life so close together?
Yeah, just seeing that gateway, you know, being the same one, right? You know, just kind of go back to where you came from. Yeah, it was obviously a very traumatic time as well. So still to this day, I feel like I haven't completely processed it. And in the moment, it felt really good to have something like Hamlet to pour all of that grief into, and then also hope at the same time. You know, whether that's the healthiest thing, I don't know. You know, it is a funnel, and it's always been where I go to understand things about life and things that are happening to me. But, you know, it's one thing to grieve as a character and one thing to grieve as an actual, you know, person. And I think that's there's some still quite a lot of unresolved stuff there. But to have this little baby boy who I named after my mom come just a month and a half later, that was really, really something. And it's just it's the biggest things, and gave a lot of perspective to it all. You know, I think since then, I've become a much less desperate person.
What does that mean?
Like I think I was always desperate to, like, I gotta be great, or I need to be seen. I need to say the right thing. I need to make the right decision. There was just all these, I need to talk to the right person. I need to, you know, make this person like me. I need to make, you know, all these kind of desperate feelings that have really finally melted away for the most part. I mean, it still comes up now and then, but for the most part, I think that's what a lot of that did. It was just reshuffle what I find important.
Another thing I can imagine happening is it shifting your whole sense of generations, because you no longer had a mother, but now you were a father. And so that's a huge shift in identity and a sense of where you are in the generations.
Yeah, sure. You know, the grief was, you know, the only unconditional love I've ever really felt was from my mom. So, like, that was like God, and then God died. And then it's like, I'll never have that again, you know, because it's a possibility you only have the one mom, but I can give that. And that shift, you know, has been a really beautiful thing to move into that, into the giving.
I read that your mother loved Shakespeare, so when she was sick, you read Hamlet to her. I guess you mm-hmm. were preparing for the role at that point.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about passages from Hamlet that have just like special resonance for you because of reading it to your mother and because you were playing the role after she died? Because part of so much of the story is about grief. He's lost his father. He believes his father was murdered, and he thinks he knows who murdered him.
Yeah. There were so many. I mean, I remember doing, What a Rogue and Peasant Slave for her. And she's just like, oh, that's very good. And she was just, she was so sweet about it. But I think the one that really, the one that really, I remember actually every night, it just would hit me in such a really intense way, which was the if it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. And that was a really strong one because, you know, we were all in a way getting ready for the inevitable, which was she was going to pass. She had been given a death sentence. And, you know, the idea of the sparrow falling, and she'd always talked a lot about that. That he knows when a sparrow falls as a sign that God cares. If he knows even if a sparrow falls, then what does he not think of you? How does he not feel of you? Something like that. So that always hit me really hard, and I'd always hear my mom in that. But the whole thing really was, it felt like a funeral for her every night. You know, I would picture her in the audience when I was preparing, and I'd pick the seat that she was going to be in, and, you know, a lot of focus would go towards that seat every night.
Well, just one more thing. You know, we talked earlier about growing up in an, you know, evangelical family with a profound belief in the inevitability of the apocalypse happening soon. And you said when you left that faith, it was either you believed or you didn't. That too was like an on and off switch, and you turned it off. Did you ever try turning it back on again, or are you still in the off mode?
I'm trying to turn it back on. I'm grasping in the dark for the light switch, because, yeah, I have found that living in just a kind of materialistic sense of things, you know, just the material world is all that's real, that feels like a dead end as well. And it's also quite an egotistical thing to be like, everything I see, that's all that's real. I know exactly what, you know, how everything works, and I wouldn't presume to do that. So yeah, I think I am in a bit of a search, and a hopeful search for to cultivate a bit more of a spiritual life.
Well, I wish you well with that.
Thank you.
Oscar Isaac, it's just been wonderful to talk with you. I'm really grateful that you joined us on the show today.
I was so happy to speak with you, too. It's been a long time coming for me. It's a real honor to talk to you. I think you're just one of the greatest.
Oscar Isaac stars in the latest Paul Schrader film, The Card Counter, which you can rent on Amazon and other streaming platforms. He stars with Jessica Chastain in the HBO limited series Scenes from a Marriage, which recently ended, but you can see it on demand. And he's one of the stars of the new film, Dune.
Just where I'm going, but I'm gonna try for the kingdom if I can, 'cause it makes me feel like I'm a man when I put a spike into my vein. The same when I'm rushing on my run, and I feel just like Jesus' son, and I guess that I just don't know, and I guess that I just don't know.
That's Lou Reed's song Heroine from the 1967 album The Velvet Underground and Nico. There's a new documentary about the band called The Velvet Underground, directed by Todd Haynes. It's now streaming on Apple TV Plus. Our critic at large, John Power, says the film captures what made the Velvet Underground so momentous.
A few days after I arrived in Los Angeles, an ultra-hip music critic at my newspaper asked me what 60s bands I'd liked growing up. When I told him the Velvet Underground, he gave a derisive laugh. Everybody says that now. He was right. In their day, the Velvets were a largely arcane taste, without a single hit song. It took the passing years to make their reputation and prove their influence. Half a century on, the band feels more relevantly alive than nearly all of its better-known contemporaries. Its songs still have the power to get under your skin. You see why in the new documentary, The Velvet Underground. Made by exactly the right filmmaker, Todd Haynes, this inventive, immersive movie takes you to the heart of the band's radical black hole magic. At the Velvet's core were two brilliant outsiders, Lou Reed, a spiky, ambitious child of the Long Island suburbs, and John Cale, a viola-playing devotee of avant-garde music who escaped his dreary childhood in Welsh coal mining country. The two met in 1964 in New York, and their sensibilities sparked. Once they added guitarist Sterling Morrison and drummer Maureen Tucker, having a woman drummer was characteristically groundbreaking, they began creating music like no other. Theirs was an invasive, often mysterious sound, with throbbing rhythms, slashing strings, and Reed's flat voice singing of hooky, stinging lyrics that came steeped in the realities of prostitution, S&M, and hard drugs. The Velvets' music was so unwholesome, it made the Rolling Stones seem about as satanic as the Monkees. Hearing their great, infamous song, Heroin, startled even a hardened voyeur like Andy Warhol, who promptly showed his genius for folding other people's talents into his own brand. Warhol became the Velvets' manager and made them the factory's house band. He put them in dazzling multimedia shows, had them take on the icy Nordic beauty Nico as their dead voice chanteuse, and designed the famous banana peel cover of their still astonishing first album. Here, Cale and later Reed talk about the kind of songs Reed wanted to record, songs that include heroin.
And Lou said, they won't let me record the songs I want to do. And that was like red to a bull. I said, what? And I said, what are the songs that you want? And he showed me these other songs.
I was writing about pain. And I was writing about things that hurt. And I was writing about reality as I knew it, or friends of mine had known it, or things I had seen or heard. Or I was interested in communicating to people who were on the outside.
He said, why won't they? Because people would complain about these songs being about advocating the use of drugs. But they're not about drugs. They're about guys who are sick and dissatisfied with their lives. Why don't we go do it ourselves?
In tracing the band's rise and fall, Haynes hears most from Cale, a vivid, appealing talker. Sadly, Haynes couldn't interview Reed, who died in 2013, although that probably wouldn't have been fun. A trailblazing musician, but known to be nasty as a rattlesnake, he notoriously disliked interviews, even walking off this very show. Still, I like to think that Reed would have respected the integrity of Haynes, whose filmography boasts three daringly original music movies: Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story, Velvet Goldmine, and I'm Not There, which casts six different actors as Bob Dylan. No hagiographer, Haynes neatly sidesteps the usual rock knock banalities. He doesn't dwell on personal gossip, doesn't keep tellings that the Velvets were important, and doesn't trot out young music stars to make the band seem relevant to the kids. Instead, he plunges us into the Velvets and their world. Using cleverly chosen black and white TV footage and flurries of split-screen images, there's almost too much to look at, Haynes evokes the artistic Hadron Collider that was New York's multimedia 60s. This is a movie full of interesting ideas about the influences on the Velvets' sound, the sexism of Warhol's factory, the importance of gayness to which Reed was attracted, and the rebellious meaning of the band's negativity. Dressed all in black while touring tie-dyed California, the Velvets anticipated punk not only in their sound, but in their hatred of hippies. If the last third of Haynes' film loses a bit of steam, that's because the Velvets did. This band that rightly took pride in being like no other fell, ironically enough, into the classic rock band clichés of ego battles, gripes about money, and purges. Burning to become a rock star, which he eventually did triumphantly, Reed forced the others to choose between him and Cale. The group made music for a while after Cale's departure, finally breaking up in 1970. But it wasn't the same. Their final album, Loaded, was merely a good rock album, not something transcendent. Early in the film, Cale tells Haynes that the band was always searching for, quote, how to be elegant and how to be brutal. At their best, as Haynes elegantly shows us, the Velvet Underground found what they were looking for.
John Powers reviewed the new Todd Haynes documentary, The Velvet Underground. It's now streaming on Apple TV+. Coming up, we'll hear from Katie Couric. She's written a new memoir called Going There. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. My guest Katie Couric has written a new memoir called Going There about her 40 years in journalism and her personal life. As she puts it, the book is about summoning the grit to make her way in the mail-run media business, adjusting to the thrilling, chilling world of sudden fame, learning on the job, experiencing institutional sexism at the highest levels, and hanging in long enough to see things start to change. Couric was the co-anchor of NBC's The Today Show for 15 years, first with Brian Gumbel and then Matt Lauer. She writes about the sexual harassment and assault allegations against Lauer, but she'd left the Today Show and NBC years before that story broke. In 2006, she became the first woman to solo anchor a network evening newscast when she accepted the position of anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News. She left CBS in 2011. She now has her own production company, Katie Couric Media. Katie Couric, welcome to Fresh Air and congratulations on your memoir. There have been so many changes in journalism and in television journalism since you started your career. And when you started your career, there were very few women in TV. I think that's fair to say.
Yes.
In your early years at CNN, where you went to after ABC.
Right.
Ted Turner's number two, Ed Turner, complimented you on your work. And he said, Katie is successful because of her determination, hard work, and breast size. So what was your reaction on the spot, like, as he said that, in front of other people who you worked with?
Yeah, probably in front of, there were probably eight, mostly men, around a conference table. What was my reaction? I was like, what? Well, you know, I'm sure I turned beet red. I was all of 26 years old. And I was humiliated. I sat down and sort of proceeded to listen. You know, it was an editorial meeting for a discussion of the day's news. I was filling in for the producer. And I just thought, this is wrong. And as I write, I went back to my bosses, Don Farmer and Chris Curl, a husband and wife anchor team for whom I worked at the time. And I said, this just happened. What, you know, I am really mad. What, you know, what was that all about? And Don sat down with me and put a piece of typing paper, a memo, you know, or whatever. And he said, let's write him a memo. And we did. And I basically said, in no uncertain terms, this was, gosh, I wish I had the memo in front of me.
Oh, but I have it right here. It's okay. On page 38. Hang on. I found your remark that I had succeeded because of my determination, hard work, intelligence, and breast size, insulting, demeaning, embarrassing, humiliating, and totally uncalled for. If you were intending to be humorous, you failed. I request that you apologize to me and that you somehow indicate to the others who heard the remark that you have so apologized.
Boom.
Yeah. What was the response you got?
He called me very quickly and was oozing with apologies. I think I didn't include that on the memo. I wrote, I'm going to keep this matter private between us.
Until I write my book.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, Ed Turner had passed away quite a bit ago. But, you know, I think what I was saying is I'm not taking this to personnel, even though I'm not even sure I understood the existence of human resources or personnel back then in those days. But he apologized profusely. I think I wrote that I liked the feeling of having his nuts in a vise. And I said, thank you for calling, but it was really offensive. And, you know, Don said, I'm so glad you stood up to him. I'm so glad he apologized. And I think in a way, with Don's support, it set the tone for me not really tolerating that kind of, you know, that kind of exchange or those kinds of attitudes.
Was that kind of comment about you or that kind of reaction to your looks a recurring theme in your early career, or was this like a one-off?
It wasn't. I didn't experience that a lot. I do write about a station manager at a radio station in Washington who asked me if I was on the pill because my breasts seemed bigger than they had the previous summer.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remembered then, too, just... like, you know, when you're so embarrassed and your whole body gets hot, I just remember feeling like, are you kidding me? But I also think, again, it was in the 70s, and those kind of comments, I think, were despicable and upsetting, but I don't think they were that uncommon.
Did you have a foundation in feminist literature or consciousness-raising groups of the period to help you think through reactions that you got and how to respond?
You know, I wouldn't say that I was attending feminist consciousness-raising groups, you know, in college necessarily, but I think I was very influenced by the burgeoning feminist movement, by women protesting in Houston in the early 70s, by my parents who were very ambitious for my sisters, as ambitious for my older sisters as they were for my brother. From an early age, I went for leadership positions. I'm happy to report I was both vice president and president of Jamestown Elementary School. And so, you know, I think that it was just ingrained in us as kids. And, you know, you read the book and, you know, my mom's motto was let them know you're there, that we shouldn't be shrinking violets, that we should be assertive and strong. And a lot of my friends were going to business school. They were going to law school. It was just a very exciting time for women who were entering these arenas, I think, in record numbers, so much more so than our mothers did, of course, but even more so than my older sisters were. And it was just very exciting.
Your husband, Jay, had colon cancer and died in his early 40s. And you had a lot of tough decisions to make at that time. I mean, you were totally broken up about this. But you had to decide whether to keep working or to stay home with him and, you know, take care of him. If you stayed at work, you had to figure out how to keep it together on the air. Can you talk a little bit about deciding to, you know, to keep working while he was very sick?
Well, I think for me and for Jay, I think having some kind of routine was really, really important. I was always with him. I had a lot of flexibility in my job. I could leave, even though this was not sort of my habit. But during Jay's illness, and he was sick for 9 months, I could leave right out after the show. I could, you know, go with him to his chemotherapy appointments. I could, you know, really make sure I was there for him in a big way. But I also think, as I said, having some kind of cadence to your life. You know, my girls were really little, and they were 5 and 1 when Jay was diagnosed. I think work provided for me a routine and, as I said, the flexibility I needed. So I was really, really lucky. It wasn't as if I had a job where I was covering Capitol Hill or at the White House and working 14-hour days. I had a lot of support at NBC and, as I said, a lot of flexibility to come in and work and, you know, reduce my work schedule because before, I was the kind of person who would stay, you know, I never left right after the show. I would book other interviews. I would shoot other interviews for upcoming shows. And I was doing things for Dateline. So, you know, I was working long hours then. But when Jay was sick, I was lucky. I was very, very lucky. I didn't have to make that choice between quitting work and taking care of him.
One of your regrets is that you weren't totally forthcoming with him about his prognosis, which was very bleak. And I'm wondering what you think you might have done differently in retrospect.
I had no right to not be brutally honest with him. But it was also, you know, he could have been more, and maybe he was. I mean, this is the question I think I struggle with, one of many in the book, is I tried to I wouldn't say sugarcoat the situation, but I tried to make it seem that it wasn't as bad as it was, and that we were going to fight this, and the doctor, we were going to figure this out. The doctors were going to come up with great therapeutic solutions, and, you know, we can make this, we can make this work, and, or we can beat this. And I think that, listen, everybody is also responsible. Jay was a smart person. But I wish that we had talked about what might happen if all of that didn't work. And I think I was so determined to keep him fighting and feeling hopeful and living a life that was as full and joyful as it could be in the time he had left, that I wasn't completely honest with him, and I regret that to this day.
What do you think would have been different if you were more honest with him?
I think maybe there were a lot of things that would not have been left unsaid. I think maybe he would have done a video for Ellie and Carrie.
Your daughters.
Yeah, like Michael Keaton did in this movie called My Life for his unborn baby. I think he might have written them a letter, you know. Who knows?
Yeah. One of the things you decided to do after he died was to have a colonoscopy on video and play that on the Today Show.
Yeah. Very appetizing. Enjoy your breakfast, everyone.
When I heard you were doing that, I thought, like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
And also it meant you weren't going to be totally out. You had enough anesthesia so that you wouldn't feel the pain, or at least not all of it.
Yes, I wanted to give a play-by-play of my own colonoscopy. I wanted to save some lives, and I had the potential to do that. I wanted to explain to people, demystify and destigmatize a procedure that, you know, can actually save your life, that colon cancer has a greater than 90% cure rate if it's detected early. I wanted to do for people in the viewing public or in the audience, I wanted to do for them what I couldn't do for Jay. I wanted to arm them with the information they needed. And that was really my only goal. I didn't think people were jonesing to see my colon, but I thought if they saw me go through it, they would say, oh, that wasn't that bad. I'm going to call my doctor because I'm 50 years old and I need to get one. And that's why my sister Emily, who is a state legislator in Virginia, was the first state to pass that insurance companies have to pay for screening colonoscopy starting at age 50 because of what happened to Jay. So I think we saw this heartbreaking, tragic situation that happened to Jay. And what have I learned that I need to share? And that's why I did it.
When you were on the Today Show, you were loved. You were so popular. I mean, you even write in your book, when you were in high school, you wanted to be the most popular girl in high school. And on the Today Show, you were like the most popular girl in the country.
But then
things changed. You know, when you left the Today Show, things didn't work out on CBS. And you were getting criticized for what you wore, you were getting criticized for the stories that you did, you're getting criticized for not making the news, like the evening newscast, serious enough.
Right. Even though they brought me there to rethink the evening news and to retool it and to get rid of sort of the anachronistic voice of God. They wanted something different. So I went there and tried to do that, but I don't think America was ready. And I mean, it would be enough just to have an anchor wearing lipstick. And then I think internally, CBS was a very traditional network. And I think internally, there were forces that weren't ready for what I had been hired to do. But, you know, I mean, I think you're getting to the likability thing. And listen, I'm so happy if people enjoy my company or they somehow like me. But that's not sort of my raison d'etre anymore. I wrote my story. It is my story. People can criticize, judge it. They can get something from it. They can love it. They can feel moved by it. But my goal in life isn't to please people anymore. I'm 64 years old, and I did just buy this t-shirt that said, I'm not for everyone. And it feels really liberating to say, you know what? It's okay. If you don't like me, that's okay. You know, that's not my mass appeal is not my goal in life anymore.
And you say your therapist told you, did it ever occur to you that not everybody's going to like you?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're likable, sometimes you are like milquetoast. You don't necessarily stand for anything. You don't rub people the wrong way because you have strong opinions. And honestly, I think if you're just likable, you're not very interesting.
You do acknowledge that sometimes when you make reservations at a restaurant now, people don't recognize your name. They ask you how to spell it.
Yeah, and that makes my husband laugh, and he always goes, it's over.
How do you feel about that?
I think it's funny, honestly. I think it's funny.
Katie Couric, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Katie Couric's new memoir is called Going There. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberto Shorrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.